Well, I want to ask you a question, first of all. I want to ask you the question, does anything, I got to see you over there, does anything bother you? Maybe a better question would be, what bothers you? You can tell an awful lot about a person by what bothers them. Some people are bothered by a failure to recycle, for example. Other people are bothered by smokers. And others, they just get bothered when there's a catastrophe and when the needs of the poor are shown to be needy. We're going to look at a phrase in today's reading of Acts that says that Paul's spirit was being provoked. One guy I was reading about this, he said that this word translated provoked has a connotation of it of like a seizure to the soul. I couldn't find it. I looked. I couldn't find it, but I don't doubt it. It probably sounds pretty, I think it's a pretty strong word. His spirit was being provoked. So we're going to see what it was that provoked him. And then we'll ask ourselves what things ought to provoke us. And finally, we're going to watch a video of a whole county down in Kentucky, a county of people where they were moved to action by a really great distress. I think it'll be really encouraging for you. It's one of those unmistakable God things, you know. God showed up, and that's what they say in this video. God just showed up. Well, we left Paul last week in Berea. We were in Acts chapter 17, where the Jews once again came down to stir up the crowds, and that caused Paul to have to move on. But when he moved on, he left with neither Luke, nor Silas, nor Timothy. He was all alone. So we're going to pick up the reading today in verse 11, a little bit of overlap into what Tim was sharing last week. We'll start in verse 11. If you're using this little black Bible, it's page 182. If you're using this fancy one, it's 111. If you have your own, I assume you can find it. All right. Verse 11. Now these were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica, for they received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so. Therefore, many of them believed. I think that's really noteworthy. Therefore, many believed. Why? Because they examined the scriptures daily to see if this was really true. The scriptures can stand the test of investigation because they're true. And they can cause a person to believe. One person told me that if the only way that people can stop from getting saved is to stop listening, because the word of God has the power, since it's true, to penetrate if you allow it in and allow it in and allow it in. Anyway, therefore, many of them believed, along with a number of prominent Greek women and men. But when the Jews of Thessalonica found out that the word of God had been proclaimed by Paul and Berea, also they came there as well, agitating and stirring up the crowds. Then immediately the brethren sent Paul out to go as far as the sea, and Silas and Timothy remained there. Now those who escorted Paul brought him as far as Athens, and receiving a command for Silas and Timothy to come to him as soon as possible, they left. Now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was observing the city full of idols. So he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and God-fearing Gentiles, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be present. And also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. Some were saying, what would this idle babbler wish to say? By the way, that term idle babbler, what it means is a picker up of scraps. And I just, I like to think about that. When you think of the image of Paul, he himself said, you know, he considered himself the dregs of the earth. And he didn't have a lot of pomp and ceremony to him. He looked like a picker up of scraps. What would this idle babbler wish to say? Others, he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know of this new teaching which you are proclaiming? For you're bringing some strange things to our ears, so we want to know what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing other than telling or hearing something new. That's quite a statement. So that's our little text, I guess, if you will. Luke evidently was left up at Philippi. That's where the pronouns change from we. Luke is the author of the book of Acts, and he says we went to Philippi, and then he says they left for Thessalonica. And we just stated that Silas and Timothy were left at Berea. So as far as we know, Paul was all alone, at least as far as fellowship in the gospel is concerned, all alone in the city of Athens. And as he waited for Silas and Timothy, he told him, he told the guy that brought him down, tell him to come as soon as possible. As he waited for them, he was looking at the city's idols, and what he saw bothered him. It bothered him in a big way. The weight of concern for Athens weighed heavily on him as he waited. Available for his view would have been, in the middle of town, Athena. Big ivory statue. They say that you could see the gleam of the spear 40 miles away. I mean, it was huge. Athena, after which Athens was named, and also Zeus. Zeus, Neptune, Apollo, Venus, Diana, and many others. Take your pick. So what bothered Paul about that? I mean, what did he see? Why was he burdened and apparently nobody else was? I'd like to propose just a few things here this morning. First of all, conjecture. I think Paul saw conjecture. It just means to state an opinion, just to make a point. I think that the conjecture bothered Paul. Their so-called beliefs were not based on any evidence, nothing credible, no fact. These gods were just concocted from stories. Nothing more. And even though the Athenians didn't know about Jesus and his resurrection, it was still the truth. That was the truth. And what these people were basing their lives upon was falsehood. And it really didn't matter how hard or devoutly or sincerely they believed, it was still an unfounded faith. The Athenians may have thought the same thing about Paul's message that Paul thought about theirs. You know, we have the truth and yours is wrong. But that didn't make any difference. You can't discredit the credibility of the gospel by not believing it. It's still true. It is the truth. And Paul knew these things, and he knew that Jesus had been raised from the dead and that a day was coming. And in the message that he gave, Tim will go over this next week, the message that he gave, Paul reminds them of this. That's one reason that some started to get up and leave. Paul started talking about the judgment that was coming. He's appointed this man to be judge. As he looked at these people, I think he just loved them and wanted to persuade them against these worthless gods. Conjecture bothered Paul. Just a statement. I mean, I studied several of the, I studied Epicureanism a little bit. Can't get into it very much this time. And Stoicism. Those are more philosophies than mythology, but it's nothing. There is an element of truth to many of the philosophies. There's an earthly wisdom that we can have understanding. They just can't practice it, that's all. They can't do what they say. And so it's conjecture, and that bothered Paul. Does today's conjecture bother you? Right here in the Luther campus, students are being told repeatedly that the Bible is just a concoction of stories. That is conjecture. The evidence is in. Jesus rose from the dead. And Romans says that the resurrection proves that he is the Son of God. Romans chapter 1 says that. And if he is the Son of God, then he is the Old Testament long-promised Messiah. And he has just pulled together all that is written in the Old Testament and proven it's all true that man has sinned, and that Jesus paid for that penalty for everyone who believes, and that those who disbelieve will endure an eternal punishment away from the presence of God and the glory of his power. That motivated Paul. That kind of thing motivated Paul. So the Bible can withstand these conjectures that are made over there, but the students are hearing things that they can't handle. And they're hearing it at such a time in their life when they just as soon be free. They just as soon believe that God isn't, that his standards don't count. They don't matter. That they're just stories. That bothers Tim and me. We pray about this frequently. It really bothers us that kids are hearing what they're hearing and they don't hear an alternative. It's not so much that they're hearing it because the truth can withstand it, but they don't hear an alternative. And they are, many of them, discouraged. We've talked to some, my wife and I were at a gathering about a year ago, and there was a Luther student there, and she was talking about a religion class that I'm speaking of here. And she said they just loved the teacher. He spoke so wonderfully. And then at the end of the almost to the end of the semester, he said, oh, by the way, I'm an atheist, and I don't believe these things. And she said that most of the kids in there, and her words, lost their faith. And she questioned, she told Patty, and I kind of wonder about mine too. This is a travesty. It bothers us. Another of the things that I think Paul would have been moved by his confusion, the confusion in that town. Few things are as anarchic, if I can use that word. I mean, prone to anarchy, and as disjointed as mixing various myths, philosophies, and religions. If you've ever tried to understand just one Greek god, you'll find out there are several versions to each one. There's no congruency to him. And then you try to put them all together in the family of the gods. You know, you got this guy, and he was the father of this one, or some say he was, and then it's ridiculous. There is not you cannot build solidity that way. And in addition to that, there's, in the mythology, there's so many human characteristics. There's arguing and fighting and selfishness and earthly passions. I mean, how can you believe in something like that? And yet, the Athenians were here continuing to look after a new one and a new one and a new one and a new one. What does it say in verse 21? They were giving themselves constantly to hearing a new thing. Well, right there, it indicates, you know, there's something wrong with the system. If I have to hear a new thing, then I'm questioning the old thing. And there's confusion there. Even Stoicism and Epicureanism that we talked about, they don't agree. So how do you know which one is right? How would you ever prove it? And so the confusion, I think, bothered Paul. He saw it and was distressed, I believe, at the confusion that would be in that town because of the confluence of gods. Well, how about in our time? I tell you, we have massive confusion in our time as well. There's always the new thing that's going to save us. It was ethanol. Then it was wind power, solar power, electric cars, a new national health plan, a new governing body. If we could just elect the right people, then we'd save our country. How about global warming concerns? Yeah, if we can just manage our carbon, we'll save the world. How about recycling? And on and on and on it goes. And I'm not saying that all of those things are necessarily bad, but they're not the savior. The problem is not saving the planet, it's saving the soul. And the problem with us is our sin. And these, all of these confusing gods and philosophies don't touch the sin problem. Oh my. If you read newspapers these days, you'll often see opinion polls or requests that you respond to an opinion poll if you're on the internet. And the reason? Because if enough people believe something, then it must be true. But that's not true. It doesn't make something true. These things are not the answer. And I believe Paul was very grieved by that. Are you bothered by the incongruent messages people are hearing? one uncertainty to the next. I've watched it. When I was at Iowa State, there were certain issues. One of them was around fuel and how you contain your fuel barrels, you know. First it had to be this way, then it had to be this way, and that was bad. And we stand here and we spent money to do what you said last time. Because it's not the issue. The major issue is the soul. And people really are as vulnerable as a sheep without a shepherd. And this should bother us. A third thing I think that Paul would have been bothered by is consequences. He was pretty sharp. He knew where these conjectures would be leading. I believe Paul would have reasoned about the consequences of believing these conjectures. And I believe that he would have had plenty of evidence to see the consequences of living these ways. He probably, most likely, saw a lot of immorality. Probably hedonism, you know, if it feels good, do it. Probably saw orphans, disillusionment, despair. It was probably all there. Why would the sins of the flesh of the Athenians be any less than anywhere else? I mean, it is everywhere, so I believe he probably saw it. I believe he would have known, obviously, that there's no hope apart from the gospel, and I think this would have provoked him. He knew that judgment day was coming. And I want to bring this to our time also. In this video we're going to watch, it's very poignant. But do the consequences of sex outside of marriage bother you? That kids are born into that kind of environment and relationship of instability. Does it bother you that the pornography industry destroys women, which destroys families, which destroys the kids, which destroys stability, and destroys our future? Does that bother you? These are huge, huge issues. We have a new idol for every superstition, a new philosophy for every annoyance, a new program for every need, a new entertainment for every hour, and a new justification for every sin. Does that bother you? I think it does. I think it should. This video we're going to watch shows what happens when God's people rightly are concerned about an issue in their area. And you'll see they didn't run to the politicians to answer their problems, and they didn't run to a new program to handle their problems. They first prayed. Yeah, this thing runs a full 17 minutes, so, and we're going to watch the whole thing. So settle back and just get ready to take it in. If you're in a right heart this morning, there may be some tears, some tears of joy. I think I'll probably cry tears of joy. It's a tremendous, tremendous success. When it's finished, Tim will come up and lead us in break of bread. He'll probably have a few connecting thoughts. I don't think you can keep him from speaking about what we're going to see. I just have three words, though, to say before we watch this. They're words that are in a progression. They go like this: prayer. I believe Paul probably prayed. It doesn't list it there in Acts 17, but I believe his life was saturated with prayer, and I think his prayer led to passion. Prayer leads to passion. God can comb our hearts. I've prayed quite a bit this year that God would just give me a greater heart for the lost. I believe it's important. We just have to work with our own soul before God. Prayer leads to passion, which leads to preservation. I could have picked a lot of different words, but this one started with P, and preservation fits. We are the salt of the earth, and what you're going to see is a preserving of the county, Clay County, Kentucky, and you'll see a lot of ways that they have preserved that county. And I just believe, I have to believe that we're up here for a reason. I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know what big things. I'm sure some of them are already in the works that we've already been touching. But I just have to believe that there will be issues up here in Decorah and northeast Iowa that will bother us. And that God will bring us to a unity amongst ourselves and amongst other churches here. Where we will trust God to do something big. And big is one salvation. Bigger is maybe two salvations. I mean, if we're going to multiply, it doesn't matter how many you start with, but I believe God is going to do something big here. It'll start with prayer, and it'll inflame our passion, and I believe it will lead us to preserve people. And one last preview here before we watch this thing. It's all in Kentucky, okay? And it's pretty heavy, but I just have to tell you, because I know some of you are going to laugh, the drawl is really thick. And so when they say the word file, that means feel, okay? And there's a guy named Beal. His name is Bill, okay? And I don't know. I don't want to list them all and make it a comedy routine here, but it's delightful to me. If you would, listen for the message and get over the drawl. Okay.
You can't put it in words what it was like, just knowing that something's getting ready to happen.
When I try to explain it to people, I can't. There's no words for it. It's just something you have to experience.
What's happening is historic. You know, what's happening has never happened before.
Why did it start here? I've asked myself that many times. Why here? Of all the places in the world, why here?
If you've ever traveled other places, you know that people will say, "Where are you from?" And when you would say Clay County, it was like, "Oh, Clay County."
The reality was that Clay County per capita was one of the most deadly counties in the state.
Appalachia sort of has this sense about it that is different from a lot of other places.
Our county was actually formed because of the cattle wars. Not long after that, we were so violent, the state of Kentucky didn't know what to do with us, so they tried to disband us.
Mountain people are the best people in the world. They'll do anything in the world for you, as long as you don't bother them. You mind your business, you be a neighbor to them, be a friend to them. They'll help you anyway, but now they'll kill you if you mess with them.
I can recall going to a house and seeing a guy that it appeared like had been shot from a distance of 40 feet right up to against him, almost assassinated. And I can remember that there was nobody that would tell you what was going on. There was nobody that would talk.
200 years of violence, poverty,
shame,
feuds, 200 years of that.
Thank you.
When I first came on this job in the middle 80s, you know, and started covering this broader territory, one of the things that I would hear about was that Clay County had the reputation as being particularly corrupt.
The elections were bought and paid for, and so they knew their vote didn't count, so they didn't go out and vote.
They never want to do anything legal. They've made a good living out of it, and here you are broke down with nothing.
Oh, it was just so discouraging.
There's something that is not right when you can deal drugs on every corner in Manchester.
They would bust somebody, take them on the courthouse hill, and before they got their paperwork filled out, they were back out, and a lot of them never went back to court.
I don't think anybody realized the extent of the corruption.
The daily fight against drugs were just about, I thought, a losing battle.
We had, at that time, communities, every community, filled with drug dealers. I mean, that's what we had.
They were selling a lot of pills, marijuana, cocaine, every drug imaginable was in our county. And, you know, I saw a lot of these kids going down that road.
Small town, nothing to do. You have to entertain yourself.
For a long time, you know, it was marijuana, it was cocaine, it was Quaaludes, you know, pills like that. But it was sort of seen as the bad people. What really started happening after 99, 2000, 2001, when you started seeing the daughters of the school superintendents and the sons of the mayors, and I mean, it was the, you know, the good kids who started to have drug problems. And that really was a wake-up call for a lot of people, that it sort of moved from what was seen as a trailer park problem onto Main Street.
And it finally just got, it just got terrible. It just, you just can't imagine.
It was just so bad, and so it was almost like every day you walk outside and it's just like on a cloudy day, it's just dark.
The general breakdown of the families have just been devastated, blown apart.
I can remember my dad going down the road and me in the passenger seat, making me lay down to shoot through the car at the guys that shot his brother.
We arrested five individuals in one household, and we had an opportunity to talk to the mother of that household. She said, I have nothing. I have no one. I have nowhere to look. I'm scared to death. And she said, I'm scared of my own kids.
And we were really in denial about the drug problem. We thought that we didn't really think that our kids were hooked. But it began to escalate, and they began to do things that were worse and worse and worse. And then it got to really be combative, and there were no good times anymore.
We used to grow marijuana right up on that flat.
Steve was probably one of the worst of the worst of the worst guys that you would ever want to tangle with or meet.
No one wanted to be around him, scared of him. That was Steve Collett.
My mom always said, if a snake bit me, it'd kill it.
He was not afraid of anything living and breathing.
What I would throw was a knife, a hatchet, and a skill saw blade. In that point of life, I decided that my only friend in life was my shadow. And so I never called anybody my friend, because I knew my shadow wouldn't tell on me. I knew my shadow would be there with me through anything. So therefore, I found out early in life there was no friends. I was the most miserable human being that ever drawed a breath. I won't tell you nothing on the inside. I'd die with you, but I won't tell you my heart. But inside of me, I was dying.
I remember sitting there and it ice cold and half naked and just remembering a piece and thinking, this is death. This is, you know, death setting in, and this is, you know, where they're going to find my body.
So I came in one night and I told my wife, I said, well, I saw Melinda today. And I said, this is going to be over with pretty soon. I said, she's not going to last two more weeks. I said, we're going to have a resolution to this.
Because everything, it was just crashing, you know, you would hear awful stories.
I just couldn't get that girl off my mind.
I just sat there and I thought, you know, I am so mad at you, God. You have abandoned me. You know, I've heard about you all my life, and you know, and here, this is what you had in store for me. You know, this is going to be my life. I can't take it.
Pulled up the driveway, and there was ambulance and a bunch of people and stuff all around everywhere. And I walked up the sidewalk to the front porch, and my brother-in-law was standing on the front porch.
I was having like one class member OD a week. Like it really got bad.
And I said, Bill, what's wrong? He said, it's Brandon. He's gone. I said, what do you mean he's gone? He said, he's dead. I said, no, can't be.
As a community, we had just failed. We kind of stood back and we had let the drug dealers rule our county.
Good people sat back and did nothing. And I'm convinced that's a big part of our problem. We talk about how bad the darkness was, but the lack of the light was more of a problem than the darkness.
Spiritually, I think our county was fragmented because no pastor would dare venture outside his comfort zone and try to seek fellowship, especially with a pastor of another denomination.
We had hid behind our church walls so long that nobody gave us any, they didn't, you know, think anything about the church. We weren't a factor. I mean, we had no hope. There was nothing we could do. It was at the end. And I mean, like we said many times, there's not going to be a next generation of Manchester. It's going to be over with. Everybody was leaving. And the ones that were staying, half of them were dying.
Who wants to live in a place like that? Nobody. Nobody wants to live in a place like that.
So we were losing all of our good people. And everybody would say, well, this is a good place to live. The truth was, it really wasn't a very good place to live. So that's where we've been up till a few years ago when God came to town and began to change things. And then one day, a little Methodist guy that's not here anymore, that looked like Mr. Rogers. You know what Mr. Rogers looked like? I mean, all he needed was a little sweater and the saw. Just a meek, good man got up and he said, we need to pray this morning for God to expose the darkness.
You have to get people in your community that are God-fearing. You have to be faithful. You have to pour your heart out. And that's what a lot of good people here did.
It's in their darkest moments that really those prayers were answered.
It's not been without any consequence to the church to step out on faith and say, we need a change.
I was scared. There were lots of times that I was scared for my pastor.
Got phone calls before church. I was nearly accosted one night at the park.
In some ways, they threatened people's livelihoods to say that we're going to do something about this horrendous drug problem. A lot of people had an economic stake in that horrendous drug problem.
I had a bad feeling about it. I was afraid something bad would happen.
About 6:55, this guy named Rick walks in. He's got a long trench coat on, and he, when he came in, I just knew that there was going to be trouble. He threw his coat back. He pulled a pistol out, and at the time, it looked like the barrel was about that long, and he just stuck it up under my nose. He said, I'll blow you away, preacher.
Everyone here has paid a price.
And as we put down our feet, we felt like Martin Luther King and all them had to have felt as they were taking their land back.
You took sides that day, and either you're going to side with corrupt government or you're going to side with God.
The officials that was watching us, they were parked in cars along the way, you know, just it's almost like you knew they were taking your name, but you didn't care.
When the pastors got to the march and we repented of our sin, and everything changed. Something changed.
Empowered by the Spirit of God.
John Becknell says God tabernacled here, and I mean, I don't know any other way to say that. He really did.
For so many years, so many people judged Clay County and Manchester and didn't think that hope was possible. Well, that day sparked hope, and it sparked a new kind of belief in Eastern Kentucky.
That day turned our county and town around. There's There's not a doubt in my mind it did.
It was just as if the evil spirits had truly been chased away.
There's just a state of mind of people now that wasn't here before.
You know, we're seeing social change, political change, spiritual change, and economic change.
Every week they're busting drug dealers and getting them out of the county.
What has been the most inspirational to me about Clay County, Kentucky is to change lives.
I can honestly say now that I have witnessed a miracle greater than the raising of Lazarus from the dead.
When you think there is no value in a person or no worth in a person, then you need to step back and look at Steve Collins. He's probably been responsible for leading more people to Christ than any preacher in this county. He has touched hundreds of people.
If he can change me and Steve, he can change anybody. Anybody. Get a
burst on it. We could talk about it for days and days and can't really get really across what all's happened to you.
We're part of something that's bigger than us, and that's something that's going to change everything. This could change the whole country.
It's just something God's doing. We feel like we've got a tiger by the tail.
This is the centerpiece of this whole thing, is that God has come to this community.
Everywhere you look and every way you look at it, just there's no downside. It's just, it's a win-win.
Thank you, Jesus, that you have allowed me to be a little part of this.